Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's James. It's the weekend in Friday, the 22nd of March. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
There's a clear consensus. The need for an immediate sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages.
Our suffering in Gaza is indescribable. Hunger, sadness, destruction. A bag of flour costs up to $1,000 in Gaza.
The situation is very bad in Haiti.
The thing is, people go inside your house, killing, raping, all those things, burning your house.
Was this completely out of the blue?
Complete shock, Mark, to be honest with you.
Politicians are human beings and we have our limitations. We give it everything until we can't anymore, and then we have to move on.
In these choppy times, to help me try and figure out what really should be leading the news, I'm joined by Chloe Hadjimatheo, one of our editors here, who spent the last weeks buried away trying to make sense of what's happening in the Middle East. You've just published, haven't you, Chloe, this three-part podcast, The State of Netanyahu. Did your view of him change?
Yes. I mean, I learned so much and I thought I knew quite a lot about the Middle East. But it's been very, very interesting tracking this man's career who's had such an indelible effect on his country and on the way the world sees his country and relates to his country. And seeing really how in various policy decisions he made, he has laid the groundwork for the war that we're in today.
It's a curious thing, isn't it? Someone who defines their country and divides it in the way that he has. I'm also joined, I'm delighted to say, by Ben Bradshaw, the Labour MP, former Culture Secretary. The last time you were here, I think, Ben, we were talking about what was going on in the British Museum and arguments about culture and the way in which we protect and defend our culture.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what you have today. And joining us for the first time is John Rose, the former chief executive of Rolls-Royce and also, of course, deputy chairman of the Rothschild Group. John, thank you. You've come to a lot of our events at Tortoise, but I don't think you've ever been in our podcast studio.
I've never been in your podcast studio, and I've also been surprised by questions for you at some of the events when I've been slightly snoozing.
So John Rose, what do you think? Okay, good. Well, yeah, keep on it. All right, well, the way it works and the idea of having people who are not journalists in our newsroom is that I think some of the best news organisations in the world worked on the principle that journalism was too interesting and important to be left just to journalists, and some of the worst news organisations get a grip on what they think matters and then don't listen to people outside. So the aim is to hear from you, challenge our thinking, our priorities. We try to start with long stories short, in a sentence. What's the story that you think should lead the news? Ben, why don't you go first?
Will the world's first ever tobacco ban in Britain work?
John?
Have we allowed Mike Lynch to be lynched?
Chloe?
No women, please. We're British.
I was going to go with Mike Lynch, but come on, let's do that. No women, please. We're British.
The Garrick Club.
Yes.
So the story is, earlier this week, the Guardian newspaper published a list of some of the most notable members of the Garrick Club. There's 1,500. They publish just a few. And we're looking at very senior legal professionals, including Supreme Court judges, High Court judges, appeal judges, at least 10 serving MPs, dozens of members of the House of Lords, heads of public institutions, actors, musicians, businessmen who belong to a club that won't have women as members. Now, Simon Case, who's the head of the civil service, and Richard Moore, head of MI6, were on that list. Both tried to justify their membership by saying that they joined the club that won't have women as members to try and change it from within. But that didn't wash, and they have since resigned their membership of the club.
Ben, what did you think of it?
I think this is a great story, and it gives us a great opportunity to indulge our sort of occasional, every 5 year outrage at these clubs that operate in this way. I completely share Chloe's outrage. I mean, in the absence of anything that's actually going to happen about it, I mean, whether these clubs, whether the law has changed governing these clubs, whether the clubs themselves decide to change, we'll be here again in a few years' time. But it's good to have a laugh at these people's expense.
But the thing that was funny about it, I thought, story-wise, was there was a bit of, you know, do bear shit in the woods about this story. It's not as though people didn't know the Garrick Club existed. It's not as though it was a new thing that the Garrick's membership is all male. What was really interesting about it was that it sits there right in the middle of London. No one really knew who the membership was. And when the membership was published, those people defended it. The defence failed and they had to resign.
Excruciating appearance by Simon Case at the liaison committee. I mean, it was painful to watch. I mean, that was in itself, given that he's the head of the civil service, was pretty worrying.
Do you think, John, that everyone should resign from this thing and that will force a change? It's odd that only a couple of senior civil servants have resigned. Why not judges? Why not actors? Why not people in the media?
I'm not sure whether anyone should resign, to be honest.
Because?
The Garrick is one of many institutions which are single sex. And I know that they're, I know and I understand the concerns about anything that excludes anybody. But why the Garrick? Why not whites, Boodles? You know, all the other ones that travel.
I agree. I'm with you. Let's go through all of them. Let's go through the memberships and publicise who's a member. For full disclosure, I'm sitting in here with three men. Do you want to say whether or not any of you are members of any single-sex clubs?
I'm not a member. I have to confess, when I started work
no
at a time... I'm the Groucho Marx of this story. No, I think it's an interesting question, which is the argument about the Garrick the fact that it's single sex or that it's perceived to be a place for the powerful?
So both.
So but the interesting thing is we wouldn't say, two streets from here, an all-women's club opened. And at the time, this was a cause for celebration because people looked and said, this is crazy. Why do we have all of these old men's clubs? And why aren't there all women's clubs? So is it the single sex element of it, Chloe? Or is it the fact that Garrick or Boodles or Whites, all these places are places where powerful, rich people meet?
It's because it's an institution for the powerful rich that run the country and women are excluded from it.
Yeah.
So both are issues for me. The fact that there are these membership clubs for the rich and powerful and so much of society is excluded from them. But the fact that 50% of society is excluded from them, women are excluded from, I think is an even bigger scandal. And I think looking at it, the fact that people like judges who preside over rape cases are supposed to have at least a perception of impartiality and yet belong to a club where when they were asked, would you like to be a member of a club that won't have women? They went, yes, please.
Can I ask you, if Ben, in your old job as culture secretary, you said, you know what? This is a problem. I'm going to step in and try and change the way in which a club like this operates. Could you have done?
I don't know. I mean, I would need to remind myself of the law on these sorts of matters. I would suspect not. I mean, it's how do you legislate against against private association? I'd love there to be an answer to that, but I'm not sure that it's an easy one.
The Garrick got a barrister to look at that. So back in 2011, Joanna Lumley was nominated as a member and she tried to get membership. And they got a barrister to look at their membership rules who said, no, no, the membership rules exclude women. And then there was a massive turnaround where the same barrister then published a new report saying, actually, there is nothing in the rules that prevents a woman being a member. And then he sort of warned the club, if somebody tries to prosecute you under equal rights legislation in this country, you might really have a serious legal case to answer for. But I mean, so women now can go into the club as guests, but they have to use a side door. And they have to sit away from the main fray, and they're not allowed to use money in the club. I mean, it's bonkers.
It is. I think the thing that's incredible about it, and it's I felt when I saw it, because The Guardian broke this story, was one of those moments, a really good call on a scandal in plain sight. It's one of those things which, you know, I've been to lunch at the Garrick. I cycled past there last week. I didn't cross my mind to think, actually, I wonder who's members and whether or not people would defend their membership publicly.
The thing is, if there was any other group, so if we said this is a membership club, we just don't have gay people as members or black people or any other group in society, it would just be screaming, you know, don't join.
Shut down,
but,
yeah.
But for some reason, this is still somehow seen as a kind of quirky British, you know, English thing on the sidelines of society.
I think there's a, you know, there's a particularity about excluding 50% of the population. And but how do we feel about all exclusive clubs? So the Chelsea Arts Club, basically you have to be an artist.
Well.
Or a patron.
There are reasons to have clubs that exclude certain people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the argument being from people, members of the Garrick Club, is that women have their own clubs. Women have their own clubs because they are excluded from lots of society. The Black Policemen's Association wouldn't need to exist if black policemen were in the majority or didn't have issues.
But let's do what John did, just for a second, let's just do what John did, because of course the real problem for Simon Case was not membership, was the lousy defence of the membership. It's perfectly possible to say, look, I'm a member of many different clubs. I love gardening, so I'm pay my dues to the Royal Horticultural Society, and I like old buildings, and I'm a member of my local sports club, and on and on and on. That doesn't affect the way in which I discharge my duties as a civil servant, and I should have a right to a private life. And the Garrick is a social place, and if I happen to choose to meet in a social place where the membership is male, that's my prerogative as a private citizen. He could have had a defence that was better, because it's not an institution of government. It's not a public body. It's a restaurant with a funny dress code.
Where networking takes place among elites.
And where women as civil servants are not allowed to go. I mean, that's and this thing about, oh, I'll change it from the inside. I think this is also, I mean, this is a good talking point. I mean, you can talk about this in any walk of life. How much can you justify being in something because you think you might be able to change it? Well, they haven't been able to change it, have they?
In February this year, we at Tortoise reported on a former theatre director who was a member of the Garrick Club who kicked up a stink about women not being members, and he got barred. He got told your membership is no longer welcome here. So, you know, people have tried. And like I said, Joanna Lumley was nominated by a male member of the club and she was not allowed.
But the truth is, isn't it, that the power, you know, these power networks of powerful people actually don't need places like the Garrick. I mean, the Garrick is a convenience. There are many sorts of Garricks and there are many that are not institutional. So, you know, there will be dinner clubs and so on and so forth. And they won't... And We can't govern those.
No, but when there's something so visible, it's a symbol of that,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Of course.
It is that bit of it, I think, is the most tricky to defend, because I do think access is incredibly valuable and hard for most people to come by. Mm. And so it's easy to say, and I'm going against my own slightly artificial defence of membership, it's easy to say, oh, it's a social club, it's a restaurant, it's a place we meet in the bar. But of course it's the case that people become members because they run into other people, you know, who help them in their working lives. Let's park this. Let's go to a working life that has been interrupted, more than interrupted. Mike Lynch, and presumably, John, you know Mike Lynch, the former CEO of Autonomy.
I do know personally. Mike. Yeah. I mean, not well, but I've known him a long time. I was on the business advisory council for David Cameron at the beginning of his term, or just before he became prime minister. And Mike was a member of that. So I've known him for a long time.
So will you just do new readers start here? What's actually happened? Where is he? What's the case?
Well, Monday, Mike Lynch started his trial in SF in San Francisco for allegedly defrauding Hewlett-Packard at the time of the sale of Autonomy to Hewlett-Packard.
And Autonomy was a software business,
and Autonomy
right?
was a software business with a hardware component to it. And my issue is really not about whether he did anything illegal, but whether it's appropriate that he's being tried in San Francisco when he is a UK citizen running a UK-listed business, governed under UK law, audited under UK GAAP, and therefore one would assume should be prosecuted in the UK. So,
and can I just get this right? The argument around his extradition and his case was that Hewlett-Packard bought Autonomy. Hewlett-Packard, back in the day, the great computer manufacturing company, components manufacturing company, it did a run of acquisitions, didn't it?
It did, under Leo Apotheker, yeah.
And they didn't go very well.
No, including this one.
And then they bought Autonomy, but the difference with Autonomy is they said that actually when they essentially kind of looked under the bonnet, it wasn't the business they thought it was, and that he was responsible for defrauding them and the shareholders of, exactly. of Hewlett-Packard. So just explain why you think that someone who is accused by the company of, in effect, defrauding American shareholders shouldn't be tried in the US.
Well, I think there are several components to it. One is, should he have been extradited at all? He was extradited under legislation that was brought in by Tony Blair to deal with terrorism, and it's one way.
And we couldn't extradite an American business person who
not under the same legislation.
Interesting.
So that's one thing. He is a UK company. He's a UK citizen. He had UK UK auditors. Why would you prosecute it in the US? I know in a sense there's the where are the shareholders of HP?
Yeah,
probably global.
No, John. What I want to press you about is whether there's a suspicion of yours that lies behind this, that although we talk about our special relationship, you think that the scales of justice in a case like this are tilted against a British citizen in an American court?
I think the answer is that yes, I do. It's not surprising. You have a different legal system in the US. You have elected judges. You have state judges. You have influence in states of big corporations who are big employers. So there are a lot of biases. But in a sense, I don't think that is the issue. I think the issue is, why have we ceded sovereignty to the US?
What do you think, Ben?
I mean, I'd never heard of this man before, but I think this throws up some interesting questions. Yes, this sort of long-running sore that we have about the imbalance on our extradition rules between us and the United States. However, I mean, I also think there is a suggestion, at least this is what I've read, reading a little bit about this case, one of you are going to be pitching it, is whether our serious fraud office has got the capacity and the legislative framework to do its job properly. And there's a question mark about that. And as to whether we take white-collar crime as seriously as the Americans take white-collar crime. So there could be an argument, and I don't know, but I would like you to explore this, if you were doing this as a story, as to whether there's a weakness in the UK that we don't prosecute white-collar crime very much and not very successfully.
There's also, Ben, I think, when I've started reading into it, John, a whole scene to this story, which is office politics, i.e. Meg Whitman, who takes over from Apotheker as the CEO of HP, is trying to essentially set a new narrative for the company and decides that one of the things that she's going to blame for the problems is autonomy. And you start looking at some of the conversations or the email exchanges, and you realize people are just trying to find a way to throw this business under the bus. And I think for anyone who's worked in a big company and had those moments where they wake up at 3 a.m, kind of seething at their boss, thinking you're trying to manipulate this or manufacture that in order to meet a bigger corporate narrative, there is an element of this Mike Lynch story that feels like that. And I don't know whether or not, I don't know how much, John, that will end up coming to court.
Well, I think that's part of the issue, which is because it's post-acquisition, they're talking about the context of the acquisition. I think that quite a lot of that evidence is going to be excluded. Now,
i.e. the Meg Whitman...
The internal communications where they're basically saying, and this is in the public domain, they're basically saying, well, actually, there is no basis for this write-down. There's no calculation we
can do. A write-down is when you say the thing used to be...
We bought it for $8, it's worth $2.
Right.
Yeah. So there is a lot of public domain information, and I don't know what's not in the public domain, obviously, but there's a lot of public domain information that would indicate that they were struggling to make the case. And their auditors were struggling to make the case, their CFO was struggling to make the case. But that's not going to be admissible in court, as I understand it, at the moment, because they're simply looking at, was there any manipulation of the accounting that would lead them to have paid more than they should otherwise have done at the time they bought it? Now, you know, in terms of, you know, their professionalism, this was a listed company. It was audited. It was followed by lots of analysts. It is absolutely true that there were many analysts that questioned the accounting on the margins, as they often do in retail and so on. There's a thing called channel stuffing where people kind of try and make the year end a bit better than it otherwise would have been. These accounts had all been signed off. You know, the auditors had not raised any questions about them. And we can argue about whether auditors always get it right. But they had the opportunity to do due diligence. They knew if the risks existed around accounting, they knew they existed because people wrote about them. So I don't, you know, it's caveat emptor. I think they bought this knowingly because they wanted to change the perception of Hewlett-Packard from a hardware company to a company that was at the cutting edge of software.
So, Chloe, I should tell you, I worked for just over 10 years at the FT. A disputed sovereignty issue surrounding allegations of accounting irregularities in an iconic technology company is just a dream come true.
I bet.
For those people who are not totally pink pages, what do you think of this story?
So it was also not on my radar, but I think there's a couple of things that are interesting. One is, you know, where do you draw the line between selling your product and bigging it up because you want to sell it and being taken to court for inflating it in an illegal fashion? I think, you know, what comes out of this case may have an impact on how other people then try and big up their products when they're trying to sell them. But also, I think what's more interesting for me is the fact that our tech industry in the UK is pretty poor compared to America. And I wonder whether this is going to have a knock-on effect on how America sees the British tech industry. This guy was our number one tech guy, you know, billionaire, famous. And, you know, he's being dragged through the courts for apparently mis-selling his company. Doesn't look good.
Well, let's take a break. And then we're going to go to giving up smoking. Being forced to give up smoking. Never being allowed to smoke at all.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.
Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasagha. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes, covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate? And how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
All right, let's go to Ben's story. Before we do, who here has ever smoked? Ben?
I've smoked, yeah.
Heavy smoker was.
John?
I tried, but hated it.
Of course. I smoked, of course. But I worked in a newsroom. Back in the day, the only place that you found out anything about how the newsroom was working or what was going to happen to your story was in the smoking room. That was the only way you figured out what was going on. Ben?
Well, yes, Britain in the next few months could well become the first country to legislate for a complete ban on the purchase of tobacco products for anybody who, as we meet here today, is 15 or younger. And this, in my view, throws up some very interesting public health and individual liberty talking points. It's a massive public health and sociological experiment that's going to be pioneered here. There's some useful and interesting international comparators. New Zealand was going down this route until the change of government last year, and they've since U-turned on it. It's being accompanied by a crackdown of varying severity, depending on what your view of it is on vaping, because there's a lot of public concern about the level of vaping, particularly among young people, and the accessibility of these fruity vapes. It throws up interesting internal political debates here, because there are some conservative libertarians, conservative MPs, Liz Truss being the most high profile, who have vowed to oppose this on individual liberty grounds. Very strong support from the public health lobby. I'd be interested in the practicalities about how this would work within families.
Just explain that, Ben. So the idea is that anyone now aged 15...
Anyone born after the 1st of January 2009...
Yeah, will never be able to
purchase tobacco products legally in this country. I mean, does prohibition ever work? Is this an interesting policy initiative at a time when most Western democracies are probably liberalising their drugs laws more than clamping down on them, cannabis being the prime example. And also Sunak's very selective approach to public health, because while he's obviously feels very strongly about this, and this is his pet thing, I mean, he announced in a great flare at party conference, one of the few things he announced, his he's completely backtracked on doing anything about obesity, for example. He's scrapped Boris Johnson's anti-obesity strategy. And although tobacco is still the biggest avoidable killer and the biggest, heaviest weight cost to our health service and other public services, obesity is catching up and will soon take over. So at the same time as banning completely any illegal tobacco purchase, we're going in the opposite direction on unhealthy foods and obesity.
And is your point, this is an example of good and important lawmaking for public health, or is it an example of something that sounds draconian, sparks arguments about civil liberties, but is too muddled to work?
I think it's both. I'm not sure it's too muddled to work. I mean, I
just don't understand. Think you've got a 17-year-old brother or sister.
No, I mean, I think yes. I mean, in a family, I mean, you have children of this kind of age. One of your children might be legally smoking and the other not. I mean, how is that going to work within?
And
within
is the
families?
Idea that over time, Ben, that essentially the market for tobacco products just gets smaller and smaller and smaller, so that the number of vendors.
It's already getting smaller, and there will be quite significant impacts on revenue from the Treasury. And one of the arguments that the new right-wing New Zealand government gave for U-turning on the previous Labour government's tobacco ban was that it wanted to spend the revenue that would still come into the Treasury as a result of allowing people to carry on smoking on tax cuts. So, I mean, it's the Treasury is going to have to find some alternative tax raising measures. I mean, you know, there is an argument. I think there's quite a strong argument for allowing people to do what they like as long as it's not harming anyone else, but pay through their taxes for the subsequent health costs of having to treat you for the self harm you inflict on yourself.
But would vote for it, wouldn't you?
Oh yes, I will vote for it. But I have some sympathy with some of the arguments of the antis, I have to say.
Chloe?
As somebody who started smoking at 14, and by the age of 15, I was probably smoking close to 20 a day, a lot. I think this is great legislation. And I think it's one of the rare examples, actually. I think part of the problem with democracy and the way that democracy works in five-year cycles is it's very difficult to bring in laws that you're not going to see the benefit of immediately. And this is a law where 70 years from now, potentially, we won't have any cigarette sales anymore in this country, which, you know, for better or for worse, I think, given the harm that it produces and given the fact that actually, you know, whether or not you argue about pleasure, when we all started trying to smoke, it's a blooming horrible thing. You've got to try quite hard, as John knows. You have to try quite hard to be cool and get past that phase. So I think it's a really interesting law that will see benefits in the long term down the road.
John, do you buy the individual liberty argument?
I'm not sure I completely buy it, but I have a sort of slightly different wonder if we can look at it a slightly different way, which is why wouldn't you just use price and restricting choice and restricting advertising to limit the uptake of smoking? Because that's what's happened really over the last, you know, two decades, where smoking has decreased. We've made the health effects more transparent. You know, we've put horrible pictures of people's lungs and hearts on packets. We made it more difficult to buy cigarettes. One of the things I find really offensive about the vaping thing is the targeting of young people with all these, you know,
peach,
flavors
cola,
and things.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Alka-Pops.
Yeah.
And we should clearly stop that. And I mean, that's a sort of slight, you know, demented eco-warrior. You know, they're plastic, for heaven's sake. They're single-use plastic.
From my experience and looking at other stories in the past, when the law changes around something, public perceptions change around it. Mm. When you look at things like being gay in this country, once it became legal, extremely quickly it became socially acceptable. The law has a big impact in the way people think and approach things. And so banning cigarettes, I think, will go a long way to people not wanting to smoke.
Yeah. Can I ask you one related thing, Ben, which is a sort of political instinct question? So one of the things that I thought was most interesting story-wise this week was Oprah and what she had to say about Ozempic. Have you seen the latest pictures of Oprah? She looks quite different from the Oprah you all have seen 10 years ago or so. And the argument she essentially makes is, rather than tut-tutting about Ozempic or meeting it with
yes,
fear.
Yes, I do. I've worked out what it is, yeah.
Meeting with
it's
fear.
It's the slimming drug.
It's the slimming, yeah, it's the slimming drug. Yeah, sorry, I should have said. It's the slimming drug. She has said, look, for a number of people, food is like booze, right? No one would go to an alcoholic and say, look, we've got a drug that you can take that will make sure that you don't reach for the bottle. And for millions and millions of people who have problems in their relationship with food, Ozempic has the capacity to transform their health and their lives. And at the moment, of course, it's the preserve of a handful of very, very rich people who are on it all the time and think, you know, they've discovered a new religion. But I think this is going to become a massive political and public policy issue really soon when people come to governments and say, how much money are you going to put in to subsidize these slimming drugs so that everyone can have access to them? Look at the public health gains, look at the economic productivity gains. And I just wondered whether you'd game out, assuming you've got an election at the end of the year, there's enough time for this to become an issue and people starting to ask, what's the government policy on a drug like Ozempic?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a treating the symptoms rather than treating the causes argument against it. And also, we don't know the long term side effects of using it. And there are other very good public policy reasons for taking action to tackle obesity and improve people's diets and also improve the availability of healthy foods, particularly in the least deprived areas, where if you look statistically, they're very badly served by fruit and veg shops, for example, but they have an absolute plethora of fast food outlets.
Yes.
And it's those sort of social inequities in our whole food production and consumption system, which I think is worth tackling in itself. But I completely understand your point. You know, if there's a drug which is available and safe, that is affordable to help people, that's great. But I still think that prevention is almost universally a better option than cure, if you can do as much as you can possibly on prevention.
John, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think Ben's absolutely right. I think we don't know enough about the drugs yet. So that's a question of time. It would be nice if it was more freely available. But I think it's, you know, again, as Ben says, I think there are a lot of other interventions we need to make about the availability of alternative, you know, better alternative nutrition choices.
What would you do, Chloe?
I mean, I think it's really interesting. And I think when we talk about prevention, we've had this report out recently about ultra-processed food and the cost to the NHS from that. So I think we do need to tackle people's relationship with food. But I also think there's something in the fact that women are still massively pressured to look a certain way in society. And a lot of the causes of overeating is actually to do with dieting, tiding with dieting. So women's relationship with food gets screwed up at quite an early age because they're trying to restrict their food. And then they end up binging and overeating. And a lot of the weight gain that women like Oprah have is through trying to diet. So I think there's also a sort of social element to this, I think, that needs to be tackled.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, completely surprising news meeting at the end of a week in which, you know, all of the big stories of our times, Israel, Gaza, Ukraine war, Trump on the election campaign continue. But these are just more in the sort of bloodstream of our lives. So, Ben, I'm going to ask you first, assuming you can't choose the tobacco story, what would you choose between the Garrick and Mike Lynch?
I would go for the Garrick simply because I think, I mean, I'm not saying that anyone can, someone who's good could tell the story of the Mike Lynch. It's very, very difficult to understand and get your head around. And also, there's an ongoing court case, whether that means you can't really say as much as you would like to when the case is over. I think the Garrick and the Women Me Too issue is a better talking point, and it's probably gonna snowball from here. All the other clubs are gonna start getting scrutinised as well, and we can have it's a fun story amidst all the kind of
spring
misery
has
gloom,
sprung,
isn't it?
Yeah, John,
I'm afraid I would go the same way because I think it's a good story. You know, so many different nuances to it, which you've brought out. Chloe, and so I think I would go with that. It's a good story about our time.
Chloe, yours?
I would go for the smoking story because I think it's one step in a direction that I think is quite different in terms of government legislating. And I wonder if they can pull this off, what might follow.
Interesting. It's a really tricky one, this, because I think the most interesting and layered story of all is the Mike Lynch story, because it has so many different elements to it. It's got the US-UK, it's got the truth in business, it's got all of these egos. So I think it's one of those stories that if you could get into it, and Mike Lynch is a way into it, is a real person who's endured a great deal just fighting the extradition for years. It's a story that I think the more you get into it, the more fascinated you are, the more shocked you are. The curious thing about the Garrick story is, as I said, it's both shocking and not a surprise. I suspect Ben's right. It is the opening of a door to a whole bunch of stories about all of these clubs, you know. And the smoking story, I think, has two fascinating elements to it. To what extent does the government use its capacity to shut things down on tobacco, but also how does it meet this issue of vaping? You know, is that a supplement or is that a gateway drug? So it's a very difficult call. For what it's worth, as I said, I spent a decade at the FT. I can't help myself. So I'm going to lead with Mike Lynch. I'll go with Garrick number two and smoking third. Almost directly opposite of what pretty much everyone else would be interested in. But thank you for joining us for the news meeting. John Rose, Ben Bradshaw, Chloe Hadjimatheo. If you think that we got those calls wrong, and if you think, frankly, none of these stories should have made it onto the running order this week, please just send in a voicemail. It's always brilliant to hear your voice, or an email, newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. And I'm going to leave you with the sound of Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, a man who seems to have been headed for the exit for as long as he's been in the job. The speculation I should just give you for free that one of many people might take it. Sharon White, who runs John Lewis, says apparently she's not interested. Melanie Dawes, who runs Ofcom, is probably one of the candidates for it. Some people suggest Patrick Vallance might even do it. But sooner or later, we're going to discover who will be the cabinet secretary. Listening to this, you can't help but think it won't be Simon Case for long.
Forgive the impertinence of the question, but can you foster a genuine culture of inclusiveness while being a member of an all-male club like the Garrick? Is that a good signal to send to the machine?
Can you get him? I have to say my position on this one is also clear, is that if you believe profoundly in reform of an institution, by and large it's easier to do if you join it to make the change from within rather than chuck rocks from the outside. And by the way, maths is also part of this. Every one person who leaves who is in favour of fixing this antediluvian position, every one of us that leaves means these institutions don't change. I think when you want reform, you have to participate.
Hear, hear.
Yes.
Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasagar. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes, covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate, and how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.